Hello, welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa, bringing you the News Gazette today, Wednesday, July 15th, 2026. Let's get started on the front page, and there's a big, beautiful picture of a baseball diamond. And it has large words that says, Diamond Days. And it's a picture of players and their Illini athlete buddies as they take the field on Tuesday for the CU Kiwanis Tom Jones Challenger League's All-Star Game at the University of Illinois' Eckelberger Field in Urbana, normally home to Illini softball. The league offers children ages 6 to 21 with physical and or intellectual disabilities a safe, enjoyable alternative to traditional Little League. And then at the top of the front page, we have an article from the Champaign County Courts entitled, Arcola Man's Trial for 2025 Stabbing Incident Begins. He claims he went to a crack house to rescue his baby girl and was assaulted, by Luke Taylor. This week, it's up to a jury to decide if a man accused of stabbing four individuals was trying to kill them, or if he was acting in self-defense. Samuel Garcia, 18, of Arcola, was arrested shortly after police responded to reports of a large fight at an Urbana residence late last year. After arriving on the scene at around 5:45 p.m. November 2nd of 2025, police found a victim with a wound to his stomach revealing internal organs. The first officer to arrive on the scene testified in Garcia's trial on Tuesday, and prosecutors presented footage obtained from his body-worn camera. As the sergeant described and was apparent in the footage, the scene was extremely chaotic with a lot of screaming and yelling. The sergeant was immediately approached by an individual being held up by two others with a towel pressed to his stomach. While the sergeant and another officer began providing first aid to that victim, they were alerted to another victim, likewise being held up by other individuals. The sergeant can be heard in the footage calling out, "We got another one?" and requesting additional units to respond to the scene. The other officer, who also testified on Tuesday, ended up going to help that second victim, as well as a third and fourth, as more kept coming from within the residence. Multiple people who were not injured in the incident were also on the scene, often yelling the names of the victims, trying to encourage them, and speaking with police. Officers secured the scene and make a sweep of the house, but did not perform a search to the extent of going through items or drawers. The sergeant testified that it appeared to be a normal Urbana residence. Prosecutors also presented footage of an interview with Garcia after he was arrested. He was taken into custody during a traffic stop soon after the incident, after an officer saw him in the back seat with blood on his hands. At the police station, he told Urbana officers that someone he knew had been sending him screenshots of a FaceTime. FaceTime call in which he could see his three-month-old daughter at the house where the incident occurred. Garcia claimed that he knew that residence to be a location where people used and sold cocaine, going so far as to call it a crack house, and he said he was concerned about the presence of his child there. "They were messing with my baby. They were doing something to make her cry," he told an officer. He left his Arcola residence and drove to Urbana with the intention of picking her up, he said. He passed by the residence once, looking for a place to park, and people outside called to him to get out of his vehicle. He ended up parking a distance away and walking up. Garcia said that multiple men came up and spoke to him, and one struck him in the face. And the men kept hitting him. He fell, stood back up, and was punched in the face again. After that, he said he got out a folding knife in his pocket. "I didn't think anyone would come, still trying to punch me when I had a knife out," Garcia said. He said there were definitely more than four assailants involved. Garcia told police he went to the residence expecting a verbal argument and not a physical fight. The trial continues today and will likely go into Thursday, if not to the end of the week. And the last article on our front page today is an opinion piece by Jim Dye with the heading, Champaign Funds Just Too Tempting Due to Loose State Rules. The federal corruption indictments filed against Urbana Democratic State Representative Carol Ammons and her husband, Champaign County Clerk and Recorder Aaron Ammons, raise a host of questions that won't be officially answered until the cases go to trial. A big one involving political consulting fees raises the specter of a mystery man's involvement. Just who is Representative Ammons' alleged partner in crime, a.k.a. Washington Willow James Darden Consulting, P.O. Box 73, Urbana? What's his connection to Representative Ammons, P.O. Box 53, Urbana? The Friends of Carol Ammons, her campaign fund, reported at least two expenditures of $3,250 each in 2021 to WWJD. But computer searches and a check with the Illinois Secretary of State business records turned up no entity by that name or individual associated with it. "We're sorry, the page cannot be found," an SOS computer replied to a computer search. The July 6th federal indictment sheds more light on the issue, even though it does not reveal the answer. Between March of 2021 and August of 2022, the D-2 forms filed by the State Board of Elections falsely claimed payments totaling over $15,000 were paid to a consulting firm, when in fact they were paid to an individual who paid a portion back to Ammons in cash, the indictment read. That alleged exchange was part of a broader effort. According to the indictment, of phony expenditures of over $25,000 in payments to individuals, a portion of which were paid back to Ammons in cash. The movement of money is all over the indictment, either campaign money or taxpayer money handed out in the form of state grants to local agencies that put Ammons' daughter, Tatiana, on their payrolls or kicked back part of the grant money to Representative Ammons. Campaign spending rules are so intentionally lax that they invite the kind of abuse that regularly gets legislators in legal trouble. Former GOP Independent State Senator Sam McCann of Macoupin County is currently serving a federal prison term in connection with lavish personal spending of money from his campaign account. Current Chicago Democratic State Senator Napoleon Harris was more fortunate than McCann. He was caught using money from his campaign fund to pay his children's private school tuition. Harris escaped prosecution, but under duress, paid the money back. In a different spending spree, Harris used more than $6,000 over several years to purchase clothing at such trendy outlets such as Nordstrom, Neiman Marcus, and Saks Fifth Avenue. Campaign spending rules allow such purchases, but only if the clothing is exclusively used for political events. But as with similar questionable expenditures, who checks and how do they do it? It's often a matter of happenstance. If curious reporters, political opponents, or criminal investigations following a money trail take an in-depth look at campaign disclosure documents. Then again, the indictment charges that Representative Ammons submitted false reports to cover her trial. Here's another apparently legal way politicians use campaign money to advance their personal interests. They use their campaign donations to make donations to other campaigns. Transparency USA reports that at one point, Representative Ammons had contributed $36,358 from her campaign account to her husband's campaign account. That made her his second largest contributor, trailing the $40,889 given in small individual contributions. Much campaign money comes from powerful interests like business, organized labor, trial lawyers, or political organizations supporting specific causes. It's intended to be used for campaign purposes, not for personal benefits, but the legal lines in Illinois are so blurred that campaign accounts are akin to enticing piggy bank lawmakers that they can't resist. It's the easy availability of that money that allegedly prompted Ammons to organize kickback schemes with those known and unknown to the grand jury that indicted her and her husband. He's charged with conspiracy to obstruct justice and obstruction of justice in connection with an alleged effort to throw investigators off his wife's trail. They're scheduled to make their first court appearance Thursday at the U.S. Courthouse in Urbana. She's represented by Tallahassee, Florida lawyer Mutaqui Akbar and Southern Illinois lawyer Angela Reaney. And he's represented by Urbana lawyer Steve Beckett. Let's continue on to Section A8 under our communities. From Urbana City Council, apartment building project approved. Critics complain it doesn't follow city's 2025 plan by Jana Wiersema. The City Council has approved a plan for an apartment complex on West Main Street over opposition from some members of the community. The council voted 4-1 Monday to approve a proposal for a 32-unit apartment building to be built on 0.6 acres at 413 to 419 West Main Street. Alderwoman Mary Alice Wu, who was the sole no vote, said the apartments that are on the site now may not be really affordable, but she expects that the current rents are likely lower than what the new units will rent at. If we think about building, and they will come, I think a lot of gentrification, right? Where people came in and bought up properties in some of the older neighborhoods and rehabbed them and basically made people cost out of the neighborhood, she said. She said she also felt the project doesn't provide enough of a public amenity to the community and noted that it does not follow the city's 2025 comprehensive plan. The plan envisions the future of the site as Neighborhood 1, a designation described as neighborhoods consisting mainly of single houses, though some duplexes, smaller apartments, townhomes, and necessary dwelling units may be interspersed. I'm not saying not in my backyard, Wu said. I'm saying let's look at the plan that we have for our neighbors. Alderwoman Grace Wilkin, who made the motion to approve, included two conditions that she said that developers have agreed to, giving at least 6 months' notice to existing tenants prior to when they need to vacate, and maintaining existing trees on the site wherever possible. For the trees that must be torn down, the developer shall make a good faith effort to look into how the wood can be reused on site, she said. Wilkin added that she discussed the idea of having some units designated affordable with the developer, but was told this wasn't part of the project's market rate model. So she asked about a minimum number of vouchers and a good faith effort. I was very encouraged that the developers did agree to that and said, yeah, sure, 4 or 5 units, make a good faith effort that we'll have at least that many units held by people with vouchers, she said. Then subsequent information that I found out showed that it's likely that the cost of rent for those units won't jive well with the voucher system, that the gap between affordable and the market rent will be too great, and that the vouchers won't be able to help those to be used if there is not the Department of Housing and Urban Development fair market rate costs. The council heard a mix of public comments for and against the development at Monday's meeting, as well as during previous sessions. This included some individuals, such as Liz Cardman, who felt that the project shouldn't have been presented for both preliminary and final review at the same time. Cardman wrote in a letter to the council that the developer should have engaged with the public earlier in the process. The current project emerged in its entirety and was presented to City Council as a done deal, with minimal public input, she said. It was too late to do anything to seriously mitigate the unwieldiness and magnitude of the proposed building. In discussing the project, Derek Brashear with developer DMCB Properties LLC said that he believes the development will produce a lot of benefits, direct and indirect. For instance, he said that having 50 to 60 people living on a site within walking distance of downtown would hopefully be a boon to area businesses. Alderman Verdell Jones III said the project has the potential to create a very warm welcome to the downtown corridor and, in his opinion, does not encroach on historic Main Street. For far too long, I think the city has kind of buckled under the pressure of kind of wanting to keep the neighborhoods as is, Jones said. And ultimately, we have lost out on growing, adding to our beautiful town. I believe that we have missed out on many U of I professionals and small families wanting to live here who don't want to live in Champaign. So instead, they go to Monticello or Mahomet or places like that. And there is a picture included from the DMCB Properties LLC plans to build a 32-unit apartment building at 413 to 419 West Main Street in Urbana, and this rendering shows an aerial view from the northwest at the intersection of Main and McCullough Street. And there is an insert in the middle of this article about Ward 6 Alderman planning to step down soon by Jana Wiersema. The city of Urbana will likely be looking to fill another council vacancy soon. Ward 6 Alderman Grace Wilkin announced her upcoming departure at Monday's council meeting, though she did not state the exact timing or reason behind the decision. The News Gazette reached out to Wilkin but has not received a response. During the time at Monday's meeting for input and communication from Alderman, Wilkin said she hopes to see the council finally make a decision regarding a proposed surveillance regulation ordinance in July. Aldermen have been discussing the matter since Wilkin and then Alderman Jaya Colasetti presented an initial draft in December of 2024, but it has yet come to a final vote. Don't know if we'll meet all these weeks in July, but I really hope so, said Wilkin, who has been on the city council since 2021. That will probably be the end of my time on council. I'll have some more updates and some more words to say, but I'll probably be here through the end of July. This makes Wilkin the third council member to leave step down this year. Colasetti, who represented Ward 4, announced her resignation in January ahead of a move outside her ward and was replaced by Verdell Jones III in March. Alderwoman Chandra Bishop, who represented Ward 5, resigned in late April due to health issues. She died on June 1st. Bishop had been living with a rare form of cancer called cholangiocarcinoma for the last 10 years. And we will continue on here. Continuing in our communities on the next page, an article about the Georgetown Fair by Jennifer Bailey. Organizers work to make event the best experience for youth. Dennis Smith says a late, longtime Georgetown Fair superintendent instilled one key focus in the rest of the event's organizers. John T. Smith's goal was for that kid to have the best fair experience that they could possibly have, Dennis Smith said, and we try to carry that through. In the hog barn, a young person who spent much of the summer practicing might only get 5 minutes to walk their pig. John T. Smith wanted to give them that five-minute experience multiple times, Dennis Smith said. There are numerous others who've been instrumental in making the fair a summertime tradition of fond memories for many families. This is a joint effort, Dennis Smith said. The 69-year-old Smith, who also serves at the fair board, showed animals at the fair as an FFA student at Georgetown High School. When he retired this year as beef superintendent, the fair board surprised him with a wooden clock to celebrate the 45 fairs he's been a part of. He says Bethany Booz, who has taken over the role, has a bright future ahead of her. It's in great hands, he said. Bethany will do a wonderful job. The beef superintendent is responsible for organizing the beef and heifer steers at the show. These are animals that will eventually produce product for people to purchase at the grocery store, Smith said. The females usually go back to the farm to have offspring. Smith said the Georgetown Fair is known around the region because there's so much care and foresight from the directors that they've had. Everyone tells us that we have a beautiful facility. It brings a lot of people through our community. The community takes pride, he said. The city workers always make sure the curbs are painted before the fair and the flags are out. Smith said families embrace the experience. This is where people spend their money as far as finding an animal and buying all the supplies needed to raise it, and then a truck and a trailer and fuel to run around to the fairs, he said. Tuesday morning at the fair had Laura DeAff of Indianola watching her 16-year-old daughters Lily and Lucy wash their heifers. Her son Wyatt, 19, also shows animals. DeAff and Smith welcomed them with open arms at the fair when their kids started showing there. She said the Georgetown Fair has been blessed with good boards, including generous donors, which have managed their money well and upgraded the facility. Mom said the Fs love coming to the fair each year. It's like better than Christmas for us, she said. You just get to be with your community and your people. You've got to find your people in life, and people at the Georgetown Fair are just, it makes small-town America work. Lucy and Lily said that they showed their cows and pigs this week and have general projects at the 4-H building, including sewing, a fairy garden, and photography. Lucy said it's fun to hang out with everyone at the fair and to be able to help little kids, too, who are just getting started. Seeing them be successful is really fun. And there's a picture of a beautiful cattle, a cow here, with a blow dryer being taken to it at the Georgetown Fair. Let's head back to the opinion section on A7 to J. Mark Powell with his Holy Cow History. And his title today is The Fake Product That Helped Save a Car Maker. There was much anxiety in the early 1970s inside Chrysler's headquarters in Highland Park, Michigan, outside Detroit. Everywhere the big three automaker turned, serious trouble was staring it right in the face. For starters, sales were declining in a sluggish economy. Then there was the Arab oil embargo, which sent gasoline prices skyrocketing to the unheard price of 50 cents a gallon or more. That was a blow to the bottom line of a company that made gas-hungry big cars. However, the worst problem by far was that American consumers were turning their backs on full-scale four-door sedans, which were Chrysler's bread and butter. The car maker needed something new, something bold, something daring, and pronto. Or it faced a very real risk of going the way of Studebaker, Packard, and DeSoto. So the boys in Chrysler's C-suite did some brainstorming. Car buyers were crazy just then for what the industry called intermediate personal luxury coupes. Two-door models that carried the vibe of top-of-the-line models but came in a smaller, more energy-efficient size. The ailing automaker needed one of its own, and so the big brass pulled out all the stops in designing, building, and promoting one. The result was the 1975 Chrysler Cordoba, designed to compete against Ford's Thunderbird and Chevy's Monte Carlo. It dazzled buyers when the first models rolled into the showrooms in the fall of 1974. The Cordoba boasted a Rolls-Royce-inspired grille, hidden windshield wipers, a ritzy raised hood ornament, and even an optional vinyl roof. However, its showcase was the interior. That was where Chrysler really went all out. It paid handsomely for an aggressive TV advertising campaign trumpeting this elegance on four wheels. The sophisticated actor Ricardo Montalban walked around a Cordoba parked in what appeared to be an old-world plaza, a Spanish guitar strumming as he gushed about pride and the very cornerstone of a new automobile. Then the camera cut to the car's interior, and the magic words rolled off Montalban's tongue. Here is the warmth of thickly cushioned contour seats, available even in fine Corinthian leather. For some reason, the American public latched onto those three words, fine Corinthian leather. They came to symbolize what set this new car apart from its competitors. Suddenly, Joe Sixpack could haul the wife and two kids, three if they were small, around town as their fannies savored the same fine Corinthian leather, here, therefore, enjoyed only by the bottoms of the rich and famous. The Cordoba was a big hit, selling 151,000 cars in its first year. It became one of Chrysler's best sellers and helped save its bacon, pulling the company back from the brink of possible ruin. Later, ill-advised and unrelated decisions put it back in that precarious position at the end of the decade. It would take a congressional bailout and the genius of Lee Iacocca to snatch it from the jaws of Chapter 11. For the moment, Chrysler's future looked brighter, thanks to Cordoba. As the 1970s rolled on, Montalban kept hawking the Cordoba, invariably including a special plug for the luxury of Corinthian leather. Sometimes it was rich Corinthian, other times fine or soft, but always Corinthian. The one detail about the car that consumers remembered and responded to positively above all others. There was just one small problem. There is no such thing as Corinthian leather, fine or otherwise. A creative writer had simply made it up. The Cordoba's interior was upholstered in pretty much the same material found in most other cars of that era. Appearing on Late Night with David Letterman on April 14, 1987, Montalban finally addressed the issue head on. Letterman said, "So what's the deal with Corinthian leather?" Montalban admitted, "Jim Nichols, who wrote the commercials for Chrysler, wanted to find a word that sounded sort of elegant, that I could say like a little verb. So, Corinthian, you know?" Letterman said, "But does it mean anything, Montalban?" "Nothing. It's a trade name." As author Paul Fussell wrote in his 1991 book, Bad or the Dumbing of America, the leather never saw Corinth at all. It was just an advertising gimmick. By the time the last Cordoba rolled off the assembly line in the summer of 1983, a total of 691,263 had been sold, and fine Corinthian leather had been available for every one of them. Going ahead now, still under our community, an article from Champaign Public Health District. Edison exposure to contagious TB case is under investigation. The Champaign-Urbana Public Health District has identified an individual associated with Edison Middle School who has contagious tuberculosis. The health district, which announced the news on Tuesday morning, said that it is coordinating with school officials and staff and working to assess students and staff who have been exposed. Individuals who may have been subjected to prolonged exposure have been sent an email with information on how to get evaluated. All students and staff who test positive for infection will receive additional testing and medication to ensure that they do not develop active TB. Additionally, the health district has established a warm line for anyone with questions about TB exposure. Individuals can call 217-531-4341 and leave their name, number, and question. And a CU PhD representative will call them back during regular business hours. The most common way for a person to become infected with TB bacteria is by spending a lot of time in an enclosed, poorly ventilated space with someone who has active TB, health district said. There's a difference between TB infection and TB disease, CU PhD officials said. People with TB disease are sick from the bacteria that are active in their bodies. They may cough a lot, feel weak, have a fever, lose weight, cough up blood, or have night sweats. Those with the disease can spread TB bacteria to others. People with TB infection without disease have TB bacteria in their body but are not sick because the bacteria are inactive. They cannot spread TB bacteria to others. About 1 in 10 people with TB infection become sick with the disease. TB can be treated and cured. According to the Illinois Department of Health, TB is potentially life-threatening, but less than 30 deaths a year in Illinois are attributed to the condition. Infected individuals who do not have active TB are often given preventative treatments as they could develop the disease later on, the department said. And we'll read one more article before we take a break. This article is from the U.S. Congress in Washington. House advances bill to make daylight savings time permanent. There will be no turning back the clock if the House has its way. The House passed a bill Tuesday that would make daylight savings time permanent. Proponents, including the White House, argued the change would provide more daylight during the times that Americans are most active. The vote was 308 to 117. And we're going to take a break here. I will return with the second half of our News Gazette in a moment.